Random House Audio presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, Enemy Lines 2, Rebel Stand, by Aaron Alston, read for you by Jonathan Davis. Luke Skywalker, Jedi Master, walked point, meters ahead of the rest of his party. He knew he'd never be recognized as Luke Skywalker, despite his fame. He wore Von Dune crab armor, the preferred defensive dress of Yuuzhan Vong warriors. His was artificial, made of lightweight materials, carefully textured and colored to resemble the living arthropod plates of the Yuuzhan Vong, but he actually preferred that. Some of his companions, wearing the real thing, had to deal with the occasional twitches and contractions made by living armor. Beneath the armor, he wore a body stocking in pale gray with blue highlights that was a close match for some Yuuzhan Vong skin tones. Except for his height, hand span shorter than that of the average Yuuzhan Vong warrior, he was a visual match for the enemy. Not that he'd be easy to see in his current surroundings on Coruscant. He was in a pedestrian traffic corridor, the sort that continued from building to building via enclosed elevated walkways at about the 100-story level. This had once been a well-to-do residential building, with only a few well-appointed suites per floor. Every door into the corridor had been smashed in, but the state of the chambers beyond, stripped of valuables but with common machinery left intact, suggested that it had been looters rather than Yuuzhan Vong at work here. And the smell of decay was everywhere. They'd stumbled across numerous remains of Coruscant residents, some the obvious victims of violence, some whose deaths had no clear cause, most in advanced stages of decomposition. As Luke neared the edge of this building and the start of one of the connecting walkways, he shut off his glow rod, which itself was engineered to resemble a Yuuzhan Vong illumination creature. Dim sunlight spilled in from the opening to the walkway, indicating that the walkway was the sort with transparent steel panels, providing what had once been a breathtaking view of this part of the world city. He felt, as well as heard, Mara catch up to him. "You did the last one, farm boy," she said. He gave her a look. She, too, was dressed in Yuuzhan Vong combat armor and an appropriately colored body stocking. "My turn." That was Garrick Face Lorin, one-time actor, long-time team leader in New Republic Intelligence. About half his usual team, designated the Wraiths, were along on this mission. He was totally unrecognizable. In addition to the Von Dune crab armor, he wore an Ooglyph masker, a type of living mask employed by the Yuuzhan Vong that had been engineered by Wraith member Baljoss Arnjak to resemble the branded, mutilated face of a Yuuzhan Vong warrior. He stopped beside Mara. "Kiss for luck?" He puckered the alien face's slitted, mangled lips. She shook her head. "I don't know whether to mark that down as exceptionally daring or unusually stupid." Face chuckled. He shucked his pack free and extracted a coil of cord from it, then continued forward, tying one end of the coil around his waist. He handed the other end and the coil itself to Luke. Face moved ahead on the walkway, each step tentative. Luke couldn't see the far end of the walkway. It was bowed in the middle, higher there than at either end, the better to support great weights, and was at least 50 meters in length, crossing over what had once been a broad boulevard. When Face was 10 meters away, Luke's helmet comlink popped, then came alive with Face's whispered words. "No excess creaking. This one seems pretty solid." The other members of Luke's group moved up to the near end of the walkway. All were in Yuuzhan Vong armor, either real like Face's or fake like Luke's. The largest warrior, with distinctive black and silver tracery on his mask and torso armor, was Kel Tanner, a wraith fond of machinery and high explosives, a skilled hand-to-hand combatant. Then there were the two Domain Crawl sets of armor, colored in swirled silver and coral pink hues, taken from warriors who'd occupied the world of Borlaeus before the splintering New Republic had regained it. The one with the more pointed helmet was worn by Baljoss Arnjack, the Wraith's expert on Yuuzhan Vong society and organic technology. The other, whose broader helmet had larger eye holes, was worn by Bindi Drayson, a woman with a broad range of intelligence skills, including military tactics, computers, and robotics. Bindi's face was marred by hard-wearing makeup that, short of close inspection, made it look like her lips were cut to tatters and the remainder of her face was tattooed. Baljus wore another of the Ooglyph maskers, his with a pair of tusks jutting from the lowest portion of the chin. Next was Elisar Targon, a Deveronian, the Wraith's medic. He wore a gray and green set of artificial armor. The thought of wearing living armor had apparently filled him with supernatural dread. Even now, as he kept his attention fixed on Face's progress, his right hand was engaged in making a series of gestures. Were they to keep the Yuuzhan Vong at bay, or to keep Face safe? Luke didn't know, and Elisar did this sort of thing so habitually that he probably didn't realize he was doing it. Beside him was Danny Quee, the New Republic scientist, who had been responsible for so many technological developments in the war against the Yuuzhan Vong. She wore the all-black armor, a living set that had originally been slated for Elisar. It was a touch too large for Danny, and she was awkward moving in it. With a moment of rest available to her, she dug a small electromagnetic radiation sensor out of her bag and began sampling the local environment. Danny and Elisar also wore makeup, though it was more effective on his typically diabolical red-skinned Deveronian face than on her even features. Tahiri Vela stayed meters to the rear of the party, guarding the approach from that direction. She was the third Jedi in the group. Still a teenager, she was a Jedi apprentice. In all but official recognition, however, she was a Jedi Knight, because of the skills and experience she'd accumulated since the Yuuzhan Vong invasion began. She wore the last of the three Ooglyph maskers, hers showing four sharp nail-like spikes protruding from each cheek and deep red crisscross scar patterns on her jaws and neck. Luke looked at her. He hardly needed the Force to sense the pain that seemed to be her constant companion these days. Her best friend, Luke's nephew, Anakin Solo, had died not long ago. Died during a successful but costly mission to destroy the source of the Voxen creatures that had proven so adept at hunting and killing Jedi. Since then, Tahiri had, except for occasional moments, worn silence and distance like a set of Jedi robes.
"I'm at the midpoint," Face whispered. "Still no creaking. I'll jump up and down at the far end to make sure the attachment there is still secure and... wait a second... I see some movement."
Then there was a new voice, a shout in the Yuuzhan Vong language from well beyond Face. The Taizo Worm, a Yuuzhan Vong organic translator, installed in Luke's ear, gave him the words in basic.
"Stop where you are. Tell me your name, domain, and mission."
Luke tossed the coil to Baljoss. "Leave the packs here." He moved forward, Mara and Kel with him, and heard the running feet of Tahiri coming up from behind. The four of them were the only ones with much of a chance in direct battle with fully trained Yuuzhan Vong warriors. Both normally and through his helmet comlink, Luke heard Face's reply, shouted in the Yuuzhan Vong language, with to what Luke sounded like proper aggression and inflection.
I am Faker Ron. My mission is the destruction of abominations and the training of my warriors. Do not hinder me.
As Luke, Mara, Kel, and Tahiri came closer to Face, they could see down the incline on the other side, where a party of Yuuzhan Vong warriors approached. Luke saw seven of them, most already holding amphistaffs in their hands. The serpent-like amphistaffs were currently stiff, in spear configuration. Face was fiddling with the fake amphistaff, wrapped around his waist, but Luke could see that he was actually freeing the cord. Luke came up beside Face and stood there, arms crossed, a stance of defiance and arrogance. Mara came to a stop beside him, Tahiri and Kel on the other side of Face. Kel unwrapped the false amphistaff from around his own waist and triggered it, snapping it into rigidity, an artful imitation of the use of the genuine weapons, though his would never stand up to the rigors of combat. The oncoming unit of warriors halted 10 meters away, and their leader looked at Luke and the others.
"This is our designated zone," he said. "Who has commanded you to hunt here?" "No one has commanded us."
Face's tone was sharp and mocking, even through the Tizo Worm's translation.
"We are not on duty. We seek personal glory. If you are not on duty, your mission is subordinate to ours. Make way."
Luke knew that no true Yuuzhan Vong warrior would respond well to such a command, and he sighed inwardly. There was going to be a fight.
"If you are on duty," Face said, "then your mission is less important than ours, for you hunt only at your superior's orders, while we hunt because it makes us great. You make way."
The enemy leader stared at Face. Then the brief stalemate ended as it had to. The leader charged, his warriors with him in two lines. Face dropped back, allowing the more skilled combatants to close the gap where he'd been. The enemy leader hurtled toward him as if to shoot between Luke and Kel to reach him anyway, whirling his amphistaff to slam Luke out of the way. But Luke went up and over the charge in a somersault, made only slightly clumsy by his false alien armor. While he was inverted, he saw Kel catch the leader and spin him back and around, slamming him powerfully into one of the transparasteel panels on the side of the walkway. The panel held, but the metal restraints holding it failed. Warrior and panel punched free of the walkway. The warrior screamed, flailing as he dropped from view. Luke landed and brought his lightsaber out from beneath the skirt plates, even as he heard the snap hiss of Mara's and Tahiri's blades igniting. His lit just in time to catch the thrust from an amphistaff. He shoved the deadly pointed tip of the weapon out of alignment, let it slide past him, and riposted. The warrior he faced caught the lightsaber blade on the amphistaff's upper end, and the blade bounced away, leaving only the faintest of burn marks on the amphistaff neck. His opponent screamed,
"Jedi!"
The cry was picked up and repeated by the other five warriors facing them, and then by other voices farther back. Then Luke could see them, more warriors running toward them from the building opposite. He couldn't count them. He thought there were at least 20, and more were emerging from that walkway opening every second. Most were screaming,
"Jedi!"
Kel Tanner turned and ran. Luke caught a glimpse of Tahiri's eyes, startled and betrayed, through her helmet faceplate before she ducked beneath the swing of her next opponent. Before she could straighten, a burst of blaster fire filled the air above her. Most of it was absorbed or deflected by her opponent's Vondoon crab armor. But one shot caught the warrior in the throat. He fell back, his throat smoking, and Luke could see Face standing directly behind Tahiri, blaster rifle in hand. Even as Tahiri rose, Face let off the trigger and took a half step left, out of Luke's peripheral vision, waiting for another target. Luke kicked a severed arm and its amphistaff up into the face of his opponent, then followed with a simple thrust to the head. The warrior was too canny or experienced for such a ploy. Unflinching, he let the arm bounce from his helmet and deflected the thrust with his amphistaff. Something arced between Luke and Mara from behind. It looked like a flat black box about the size of a human hand, with glowing letters or numbers on one side. And Kel was once again in Luke's peripheral vision, this time with a blaster, holding it high over the head of the Jedi, pouring fire down into the Yuuzhan Vong,
Suggest we retreat fast, he shouted. 10.
What was that? Luke asked. Instead of blocking the next ampi-staff blow to come his way, he leaned forward before the blow began and whipped his lightsaber across his new opponent's wrist, severing the holding hand.
You know what it was. 7. 6.
Luke began to back away fast. Mara and Tahiri kept pace with him, and Face and Pell kept at the blaster fire, joined by an occasional single-shot blast from their allies behind. They'd almost backed into the opening to the building when Kell's explosive charge detonated. Suddenly, the walkway in the midst of the Yuuzhan Vong force was a wall of fire rushing toward them. Luke exerted himself, hurling himself backward with use of the force, yanking Mara and Tahiri with him. They landed several meters back in the building corridor, still deflecting thrown thud bugs and razor bugs. Then the fiery flash from the explosion roared across the intervening Yuuzhan Vong and past the Jedi, momentarily blinding Luke, hammering him backward. Sure in his sense of where the other Jedi and Wraiths were, he whirled his lightsaber in a defensive motion he seldom used outside of practice, felt it hit something hard and unyielding. Then the heat and brightness were past. He found he was locked. Lightsaber against Amphistaff, with a warrior whose back was smoking. Three other warriors stood among him and his allies, though two were now dancing in concentrated fire from the Wraiths and Danny Kui. The last, in the middle of a quite elegant snapkick against Mara, was receiving her lightsaber thrust up and under his skirt plates. Luke kicked out, catching his opponent in the center of the torso, sending him hurtling. The warrior staggered back to the walkway aperture, then dropped out of sight with a shout of surprise. The walkway was gone. Only smoke and the jagged edges where it had once joined the building suggested it had ever been there. Even with his ears ringing from the explosion, Luke could hear the smashing, grinding noise as its wreckage descended hundreds of meters to the boulevard below. They stood panting for a moment, Jedi, Wraiths, and scientists staring at one another. Face's tone became professionally worried.
So, does that count as my turn, or do I have to check out the next walkway?
Luke grinned. It counts as your turn.
The next one, Kell said, will be 20 or 30 flights down. We'd better get to it.
Bindi slapped the back of Kell's helmet. That one is going to have been hit by debris from this one, explosion boy. We go up. His tone subdued, Kell said,
I knew that.
The tall man pounded on the black stone wall. The wall stretched up as far as the eye could see, at least in these dimly lit reaches of the ruined undercity, and was angled back, not truly vertical. The stone from which it was made was glossy, with little gray stipple patterns throughout, lending it beauty and complexity. The wall did not seem to be made of blocks of the stone. The entire wall seemed to be one sheet, unmarked by lines or creases. The stone held up against blows from his fist. He found a block of ferrocrete nearby and swung it with all his considerable strength at the wall. The ferrocrete shattered. He ignited his weapon. It hummed with every move of his arm and cast its red glow on the stone. He drove it into the stone. The stone did not warm, did not burn, did not melt away. He withdrew his blade and touched the point where it had rested. It was warmer than the surrounding stone, but did not burn his flesh. He shouted, the echoes of his anguish bouncing off the high ceiling and nearby walls of this chamber. He had to have what was beyond the wall. It was everything. He had never seen it, never felt it, but he knew it was there. The tall man felt something, a presence nearby. He raced to a mound of rubble, collapsed from ruined ceiling, and swept a block of duracrete aside. In the niche beyond, huddled a small figure, a human male,
The tall man reached in and seized the other, yanking him forth. The smaller man wore rags and stank of sweat, months of sweat. His hair was long and ragged, and fear filled his dark eyes. The tall man did not speak to him. He did not know words. Instead, he made a thought, an image of the black wall shattering, opening to reveal the treasure beyond, and shoved it into the mind of the other. The smaller man stiffened and shrieked as the thought lodged in his mind occupied it fully. Then the tall man sent another thought, a question. How? The smaller man trembled in his grip, and thoughts, hundreds of them, tiny and scurrying like rodents, flashed through his mind. Then there was an image, a machine, something a man could hold in two hands. From its nozzle came a blinding blaze, a cutting fire. The small man thought of that fire piercing the wall, cutting a door, allowing the tall man through. The tall man formed another thought. In it, the small man would go forth, find that machine, and bring it here. Immediately. With ruthless strength, he hammered that thought into the small man's mind, heard his new shriek. Then he dropped the small man. His new slave, weeping, sobbing, ran off into the darkness. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior, Chul Kang La, was old, far older than any who had been seen by the natives of this galaxy. Under the scars, tattoos, and mutilations that rendered his face almost black and his features almost unrecognizable were deep wrinkles of age. He stood in his preferred control chamber of the Domain Hul worldship. The walls were thick with the stations of his various advisors and subordinate officers, including his personal aide, the warrior Kazdak Bul. Above Chul Kang La's seat was a great membranous lens, in diameter three times the length of a tall warrior. It gave him an unparalleled view of the space before Domain Hul, and could contract to magnify very distant objects. Before the old warrior stood a priest. He was tall, his leanness suggesting self-deprivation, and he wore the ceremonial robes and head wrap of the Order of the Trickster Goddess, Yun Harla.
"Welcome, Harar," Chul Kang La said. "It is my honor to come before you again."
The priest offered the sort of bow that equals exchange, then straightened. Chul Kang La continued,
"I am directed by my son to offer you every assistance in capturing Jaina Solo."
The old warrior beckoned to a much younger male who waited near the wall. The younger warrior stepped forward and knelt. Chul Kang La looked back at Harar.
"Harar, I bestow upon you Charat Kral. He has been in charge of special operations where Jaina Solo and other matters are concerned. He leads an inventive and well-motivated unit made up of Kral and Hul pilots and knowledge harvesters. My burdens of command will be lightened rather than increased if you simply take him off my hands and assume direct control of those operations."
Harar addressed the younger warrior.
"Do you feel you can readily transfer your service?"
The question was a matter of life and death. Should Charat Kral in honesty say he could not, he would naturally be killed and a more agreeable commander installed. Charat Kral raised his head to look into Harar's face. The warrior's nose was not just deformed, a mutilation common to Yuuzhan Vong warriors, but entirely missing, with ragged reddened edges all around to suggest the violence with which it had been removed.
"My duty is to the gods, our leaders, and Domain Kral," he said. "I will serve gladly."
"Good," Harar said.
When my audience with Chul Kang La is done, you will come with me and tell me of your plan.
As his group entered a long gallery that had once been flanked by stores and emporiums, Luke again felt a twinge, some distant wrongness in the Force. The sensation had come to him before, and he had steered toward it, hoping that it was the source of the unease, the visions that had brought him to Coruscant on this mission. But his fellow Jedi had not always seemed to share his perceptions. He glanced at them. Mara was already looking his way, nodding. Tahiri stared off into the distance, in the direction of the twinge, alert as a hunting beast. Even Dany was gazing in that general direction, a hint of confusion evident even through her Yuuzhan Vong makeup. "Did any of you feel something?" she asked. Another feeling intruded on Luke's finely tuned senses, a whiff of danger, far more immediate than the previous sensation. He whispered, "Trouble." A great roar of voices sounded from ahead and above. Out of two storefronts at this level, and one on either side on the first balcony level above, came a stream of beings, shouting, charging toward Luke and his party. They were humans and humanoids, male and female, their clothes largely filthy and in tatters, carrying primitive spears and knives and crude swords in their hands. In moments, at least 50 were charging Luke's position, and more were pouring out of the doorways. Luke breathed a sigh of relief. "Time to make contact," he said. He reached up for his helmet. "Run," Bindi said. Bindi suited actions to words by turning back the way they'd come and racing away from the oncoming mob. Luke looked at Mara. Both shrugged, then turned to follow Bindi, the rest close after them. Bindi angled into a doorway that led to an emergency stairwell. She led them up the stairs two at a time until they'd climbed five flights. Then they could emerge into a much darker, narrower corridor. There they stopped, many of them panting. Kel leaned over to put his hands on his knees as he struggled to breathe.
"I'm too old for this."
Dany leaned against the wall. "Would you mind telling me why we ran? I thought you wanted to make contact with pockets of survivors. Something about setting up resistance cells?" Bindi offered her an unlovely smile. "Two reasons. First, normal people who want to stay alive don't charge Yuuzhan Vong warriors that way, even if they outnumber them 100-1, meaning that they probably had some way to kill those supposed warriors, like retreating before us and leading us to a spot where 50 tons of scrap can drop on our heads." Dany considered that, and her expression relented. "Good point." "Second," Bindi continued, "we don't have any reason to believe that any of the Vong warriors who attacked us on the walkway are still alive. So our secret, the fact that we're wandering around in effective Yuuzhan Vong disguises, is probably intact. If we let 100 starving survivors know about it, inevitably, one will sell us out, and the Vong will know too."
"So," Luke said, "a detachment of us take off our disguises and go to talk to them as humans."
"While the rest wait here and breathe," Kel said.
"Right." Luke looked over them. "It'll be me, Mara, Face, and Bindi going back. The rest, stay here." Luke, now dressed in the dark garments he affected whenever making a public appearance in the guise of Jedi Master, stared at the woman on the other side of the heating element, protruding from the gap in the floor panels. He, his three companions, also in dark, inconspicuous civilian dress, and six men and women of the Walkway Collective sat cross-legged on the floor, in a loose circle around the heating element, while a pot of greenish soup rested atop the thing and gradually heated to boiling. "How have you survived?" Luke asked.
They were in a back room of what had once been a clothing emporium of the Cadier walkway, the shopping gallery where Luke's party had so recently been attacked. The woman he addressed, once plump and blonde, he thought, now leaner from a subsistence diet, hair streaked with dirt, brown eyes hard from sacrifice and suffering, was Tenga Javik, nominal leader of the Walkway Collective.
"We've rigged photon collection screens and heat harvesters for power," she said. "One of us worked at a Greyweave production plant."
Greyweave was the nickname for a sort of single-cell organism-based food, manufactured for and sold to the poorest of the poor. In texture, it looked like thick, gray felt, but didn't taste anywhere near as good.
"We stole the Greyweave reactors and scattered them all through our territory," Tenga said. "Well hidden. We keep them supplied with power and water, water we process through our own stills. We hide from the Bong most of the time, set traps for them when we're sure we can take them."
She met Luke's eyes, her expression suddenly fierce.
"When will the fleet come, Master Skywalker? When can we expect relief?"
"Not soon," he admitted. "I wish I could tell you differently, but you're going to have to rely on yourselves for some time to come."
Several of Tenga's fellows sighed or made noises of discontent, but they didn't direct anger at Luke. His words did not seem to be entirely unexpected. Tenga returned her attention to the soup.
"We need the fleet," she rasped, her tone lower.
She did not seem to be speaking to Luke.
"We need the Jedi."
"This is our first mission back," Luke said, projecting confidence with his voice and through the Force.
"And more will come. We're not going to let Coruscant remain in enemy hands."
"First things first," Mara interrupted. "A little more information. Have any of you seen or felt anything unusual in this region? I mean, unusual in excess of all the changes brought on by the Vong." Most of those present shook their heads, but one, in the second rank of the circle, a thin, middle-aged man named Yasat, with a dark, suspicious look to his features, said,
"Lord Nyax."
Some of his companions sighed. One or two offered up little groans. Luke grinned before he could suppress it. "That's a children's story."
"He's real," Yasat said.
Mara raised an eyebrow. "I haven't heard this one." "In ancient times," Luke said, "on Corellia, Lord Nyax was what parents threatened their children with if they didn't eat their stew fruit or go to bed on time. If you keep on being a bad boy, Lord Nyax will come for you. He was a monstrous pale ghost who took children away, and no one ever saw them again."
"A typical folktale," Mara said.
"Yes." Luke sobered. "But a while back, stories of Lord Nyax got a lot more common, because during the Jedi purges, there was someone who came for children in the night. Someone who came for Force-sensitive children." Mara's reply was a whisper.
"Darth Vader."
"That's right," said Luke. "I think that some of Darth Vader's covert missions to round up Force-sensitive children became merged with the Lord Nyax legend and spread from Corellia all over the galaxy during the early Empire years."
"Yasat here is one of our Far Scouts," Tenga said. "He travels out beyond our territories, exploring and scavenging."
"And he sees things," another said.
That man tapped his temple with one hand while jerking a thumb at Yasat with the other, suggesting that Yasat was not completely functional in a mental sense.
"I do see things," Yasat said, "but they're there."
"Tell me what you see," Luke said.
"I saw Lord Nyax for the first time about a month after Coruscant fell."
Yasat's voice lowered in tone and volume.
"This was over toward the old heart of the government district, where things are crazy now. I was on one side of the main chamber of a textile factory, hiding from a Vong hunting party. They were on the other side. I was already scared, but I got a lot more scared and didn't know why. Then the screaming started. Where the warriors were, I could see someone moving. A big man, ghostly white. There was a roar and flashes of red all around it, but no sound of blasters. I got away. Hours later, I came back. I found the Vong warriors dead, chopped to pieces, burned in places. Some of them eaten on.
Where have you run into Lord Nyax? Luke asked. Yasat pointed northwest, precisely in the direction where Luke and the other Force sensitives had felt the twinge.
That way, near the old government center. It's thick with Vong compared to here, but full of interesting salvage.
We need to look at that, Luke said. He addressed Yasat. Care to come with us? To guide us? Yasat shook his head.
Prowl around with a big noisy party when there are Vong hunters about? No. Kill me now instead. It'd be less painful.
Luke shrugged. We'll be back then. Yasat offered him a look of sympathy.
No. You won't.
Jaina stood up, her bedsheet whirling away from her, and lurched to her closet without knowing why. The sun Pyria was just now climbing above the horizon, so she had been in bed for perhaps 3 hours. The roaring in her ears resolved itself into an alarm. Yu Zhan Vong were coming. She heard the roar of thrusters from whichever squadrons were at the ready. It would be Black Moon at this hour. Jag Fel was waiting for her in the hallway, the special secured hall of the Biotics building, reserved for the pilots of Twin Sun Squadron. Other doors were sliding open. Piggy Sabinring, struggling to fasten the seal of his pilot suit over his expansive Gamorrean stomach, emerged. What's our objective? Jaina asked. Jag held out a data pad for her to look at, but her eyes wouldn't focus on it. She irritably waved it away.
It looks like an assault on this location, Jag synopsized. Flying vehicles only, no sign of ground troops. Lusankyu's squadrons have some of the enemy forces engaged in orbit. More will be here in moments. There was an explosion. All the transparasteel viewports on the west face of the building rattled.
Correction, Jag said. They'll be here now. Let's move. Jaina led her half-dressed, half-awake squadron to their turbo lift. Twin Sun Squadron roared westward toward the Yu Zhan Vong cruiser analog. Piggy, analysis, Jaina called. The mechanical voice of a Gamorrean pilot boomed from the comm unit. Jaina winced and slid the volume control lower.
They're not concentrating on the Biotics building this time, Piggy said. They should be concentrating their efforts on removing Lusankya from the battlefield, so they can then move against the facility with minimal opposition. They are not.
Jaina didn't have to ask what that meant. The Yu Zhan Vong didn't intend to overrun the facility this time. They had some other goal, such as staging another attempt to capture Jaina. To the Yu Zhan Vong, twins were sacred, and Jaina, as the twin of Jason, held special fascination for them. Keep your eyes open for particular attention on us, Jaina said.
Yes, Great One.
Jaina hit her thrusters and accelerated toward the enemy. Let's do this thing. In his transport, far below the Lusankya conflict and as far above the war waging around the Biotics building, Harar stared into the viewing lens mounted in the transport's belly.
Where are the Star Lancer vehicles kept?
The Pipe Fighters, Harar asked.
He referred to the craft that had, not long before, set up a complicated energy matrix in space in the Pyria system, then fired a laser attack,
one that had been somehow accelerated through hyperspace and had actually struck the Yuuzhan Vong worldship in orbit around Coruscant. Charat Kral knelt beside him at the edge of the lens and indicated a square flat building near the biotics building.
That is where their elites keep their vehicles. Jaina Solo Squadron is housed there. It is not a target of today's exercise, since most of the vehicles housed there are now coming against our forces. And where are they growing their lambent crystal?
The recent spying efforts involving a controlled human male had indicated that the Starlancer project required the implementation of a gigantic crystal, one grown from Yuuzhan Vong techniques and material, to increase the long-distance laser enough for it to do real harm to distant targets. Charat Kral pointed to the biotics building.
There. Our agent was unable to search every portion of that structure, but eliminated many. Before he was lost, he communicated to us that he thought the deepest levels of the building, which are among those shut off from the common soldier, were the most likely location for the crystal growing.
He had a hard time saying the next word, so hateful was it in this context.
Machines. Our next agent will find it and arrange for its destruction, if our bombardments do not destroy this facility first. Excellent. Now, let us discuss the capture of Jaina Solo.
Jaina let off her trigger as the coral skipper in front of her detonated. Its pieces rained down on the jungle below. A quick check of her sensor board revealed that her wingmates, Jag Fell and Kip Duran, were not far away and were inbound toward her. Ahead was the Yuuzhan Vong cruiser, hundreds of meters of Yorick coral and organic weaponry. "Let's give its big guns something to think about," Jaina said. She switched her lasers over to quadfire and began pouring coherent light blasts at the points the cruiser's giant plasma cannons sprouted from its hull. "What's your status, Tilath?" Jaina asked the Twin Suns 11 pilot.
"Lined up on final approach. I'm 15 seconds from optimum firing range. 14.
"Fire when you come ready. Don't wait for my command."
10.
Jag and Kip joined their laser fire with Jaina's. The voids protecting the cruiser analog had no difficulty moving into position and swallowing the destructive energy from their weapons.
1. Firing.
The missile dropped from the belly of Tilath's X-Wing. It fell a dozen meters, then its rear ignited, driving it forward at missile speeds. Jaina clicked her comm board over to operational frequency. "Execute low bounce. Repeat. Low bounce." In the vicinity of the target cruiser analog, New Republic starfighters began gaining altitude. They didn't flee. They just rose until they were above the cruiser analog's altitude. They continued fighting on their way up, continued fighting at their new altitude. At the same instant, Jaina, Kip, and Piggy armed and fired proton torpedoes, one each. Half a kilometer short of the cruiser analog, Tilath's missile did what it was supposed to. It did not shatter and fly in all directions. It was too sturdily built for that. Most of the missile was an extremely durable metal tube, open at one end. The rear, closed portion was packed with a plasma-based explosive charge. The forward two-thirds, sealed only by the fragile nose of the missile, was packed with metal ball bearings the size of human heads. The plasma charge detonated, superheating the ball bearings and firing them toward the target. They shot out, a spreading display of superheated projectiles. Not one of the ball bearings would do significant harm to the target when they hit. The best-placed shots that actually hit the Yorick coral hull would punch through and lodge within, while the rest would bounce harmlessly away. No, The danger they represented was not from hitting. Each ball, heated by the plasma charge, was now identical in specific gravity and temperature to the proton torpedoes catching up to them from behind. The cruiser analogs dove in basals, sensed the incoming horde of missiles. They did not panic. Fear was not part of their nature. But they knew they could not project their voids into the path of even a fraction of the incoming missiles. Instead, each prioritized, projecting its voids over the most vulnerable portions of the vessel's flank, protecting the command crew compartment, weapons emplacements, and itself. Charat Kral and Harar watched as the twin suns launched four missiles, one the largest ahead of the others. The largest one detonated short of its target, showering the Matalok with red-hot debris. But the others flashed straight into hit, 1, 2, 3, against the Matalok's side. The infidel weapons flashed impossibly bright, creating clouds of explosive force and debris that had once been the side and internal organs of the Matalok. The vessel heeled over, mortally wounded, and began to turn away from the engagement. Plasma poured from its injury. It gained altitude for a moment, then settled into a straight-line course. And now its dove-in basals concentrated their void protection only over the main weapons emplacements. Charat Kral knew what that meant. The Matalok would not make it back to space, so its commander was ordering the weapons to build up tremendous charges of plasma energy, charges that would destroy the vessel from within. Charat Kral sagged as energy and pride left him for a moment. He slammed his fist into the floor next to the viewing lens.
"How did she do it?" he asked. "How did she persuade the Dovin basals to let their missiles through?"
"I do not know."
Charat Kral met the priest's gaze.
"It is not my place to ask this. You may choose to order me to my death for asking, but I must know. You are a priest of Yun-Harla. Surely the truth is in your mind. Is Jaina Solo an avatar of the goddess? Is she the goddess?"
"Of course not.
She is an infidel who mocks our goddess."
But Harar knew that he was no longer able to project confidence when he said such words. He no longer knew whether he was telling the truth. The small man had a name. It was Ryuk. He trembled in his need to discharge his duty, and his trembling made his actions awkward, uncoordinated. He stood wearing protective lenses over his eyes, holding the cutting device he had shown the tall man. Flame, concentrated into a point like a needle, poured out of the device's nozzle, and Ryuk pressed it into the stone wall. The tall man watched him. He waited with growing impatience for the device to cut its hole so he could enter. But minutes passed, and though the stone warmed to the point that it glowed, it did not melt, did not retreat. At last, the cutting device made a noise like a cough, and the flame vanished. Ryuk, expression fearful, turned to the tall man and tried to express a thought. It was a bad thought. It meant that the device didn't work anymore. Even if it worked forever, Ryuk seemed to be saying, it would not cut through this. Bitter disappointment filled the tall man's heart. He gestured, shoving, and Ryuk slammed into the black stone. The tall man heard Ryuk's bones break, and as Ryuk slid down the surface of the stone, saw blood trailing behind. He felt Ryuk's thoughts go from fear to quiet to nothingness. The tall man needed another person, someone smarter, with better machines. He turned to leave. He would find such a person.